sorts of diverse topics, and people from hackerspaces and hackerspace wannabe people can get together and collaborate on projects in this big meta international hackerspace with lots of cool stuff going on. There's my contact information. I'm doing this also with Jimmy Rogers, who does a lot of workshops with me. There's his contact information. Feel free to contact me or Jimmy about absolutely anything. Next slide. So my motivation for doing all this is because I love teaching people what they want to learn. And I love electronics, so I love teaching that, and it seems a lot of people love it. Look at all those happy people soldering. Anyone can learn to do that. Collectively, me and Jimmy have taught almost 40,000 people how to solder. You can do it. Anyone can do it. I've taught 3.5-year-olds. So next slide. I wrote a comic book, which you can look online, Solder Comic. It's not only in English, but also in just about any language in Europe and many in Africa and around the world, including Chinese and Morse code. It's open source, like all my projects. Go ahead. Here's some of my projects that are available for learning how to solder and make things with electronics. Anyone can do any of these projects. They're all totally for beginners to complete successfully. If you want, you can come up. We have demos for all of them on the mezzanine. Come on by. You're all welcome. Next slide, please. There's some more of them. Cool projects, making noise, playing games, interactive art, of course, a lot of blinky lights. Next slide. Also, I'm going to do, this is just one of the many, many cool workshops that are happening, Arduino for total newbies. In 3 hours, knowing absolutely nothing, I mean total newbies, you can go from knowing absolutely nothing to being able to make a cool project with Arduino and being able to hack things online with these marvelous open source devices. My teaching is always free, but the parts, of course, cost money, so I ask to be reimbursed. The first 50 people show up early, can do it. So show up early if you want to do it. It will fill up at 7 o'clock tomorrow in the Hackerspace Village hardware hacking area. Next slide. Jimmy was going to do this, but he doesn't have anything planned. But if you want to do it, just find Jimmy or find me, and I'll point you to Jimmy. Bring your own toy or an easy button or anything you want to turn into a noisemaker, and we'll show you how. Next slide. So just come on by. It's you can learn to solder with any of these kits. You can do learn on the all the workshops that will be happening. But the ongoing soldering workshop will be happening all day, all night, until hope ends, which is a long time from now. Go ahead. Next slide. So there's my contact information again. So hope to see you all. And soldering is not only fun, but it is easy.
Great. Thank you, Mitch. And with 1 minute to spare.
Awesome. Yep.
Great. So, Johannes.
Awesome. Okay. Give Mitch a round of applause and the same round of applause for Johannes. Thank you. Okay. Johannes actually has a video which will be playing in the back, so we're going to reset you. And this
Excellent.
Is not the
okay.
talk, but are we queued up with the video back there? Yep, we are. Okay, cool. So start. Go.
Okay, so in fact, I'm up here because Nick Farr jumped me 2 hours ago, like not sexually, but he said, come on. Oh, I wouldn't mind. Okay, but so he came up and said, the lightning talks, we don't have enough lightning talks. So for tomorrow, come on, get up so I don't have to do it a second time or something. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, anyhow, Nick Farr asked me I should do a lightning talk, and I say, yeah, why not? I want to talk about a project we're doing right now. It's a feature film. We want to do it, and we could need your help. I will actually talk about it in more detail today at 9 o'clock, but to attract you, I thought, why not go on stage here and do it. The basic problem is, how can we do a feature film about the big problems of the digital age? Because there are so many problems out there we have to talk about, even like and especially in narrative film. But nobody's addressing those problems because it's easier to make a film about a bank robbery than about the real problems that we have out there.
If you want to show your video, you've got 30 seconds.
Yeah. What? Okay, let's show the video.
Your videos include your time.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our glorious home country of Soviet Unterzegersdorf.
This is Ambassador Khrushchev.
This is Blogger.
I blog.
Our little country is a proud one because we are the last Soviet republic on the planet. We are in Central Europe, located there. There. Yeah. We want to tell the West the story of our greatest triumph.
And how do we want to tell the story? We want to make a feature film, a dark sci-fi comedy.
Because we know you will like it. Don't touch it, girl. This is a United Nations camp with the name of Sierra Zulu.
The film will be about this camp, and this United Nations camp is on the border between our wonderful home country of Soviet Unterzegersdorf
and the West,
the so-called free world.
Here it is, in a symbolic fashion. Kick it, destroy it, crack it open. Free market wankers, we hate you, but we need you. Why do we need you? The internet is made for corn and crowdfunding.
And we need money from the internet, so we also have a cat.
Yes. We attracted a number of glorious actors already. They signed us letters of intent. They cannot say no any longer. It is Robert Picardo, a doctor. We have Amber Benson. She was a lesbian on Buffy. This is the boss, Fruit Computers. We have... What is his name?
Jello Biafra.
He was a punk singer indeed. And this guy, nobody recognizes him because he was a Ferengi on Star Trek. His name is Max Prudencik, the Rom. Yes.
From Star Trek, Deep Space.
Top Space Voyager. Yeah, and
we want your money and we have to say, please,
because we cannot force you. Good night.
To get the money. Because I'm sick of this shit.
You get to eat so warm, Wesh.
So, and why this crazy shit up there has anything to do with hackers or something?
Extra minute?
No,
okay. No, you're good. They like you. Keep talking. You've got 40 seconds.
Why is this like shit about this like strange Soviets in the middle of fucking nowhere in any way interested to you hackers out there? And I'll tell you about that tonight at 9 o'clock if you want to hear it. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Up next, we have Sam... Actually, I never got the pronunciation of your last name. I'm sorry.
Bound.
Sam Bound. Can we get his slides up? They're on... Yep.
Why?
So... Johannes, we haven't actually had anybody come close to the time, and so, because we didn't practice that part, if I go like this, do you guys know what to do? 9, 8, 7, 6. No, okay. Normally the audience goes, or makes some kind of noise like that. So, but from 3, do you want to practice that one? So. All right. Okay, that was creative, but without any further ado, Sam Bone, take it away. 5 minutes.
All right. And I take it as a compliment that as a college teacher, I'm expected to be so long-winded that you'll have to shut me up by force. So anyway, I'm Sam Bone. I teach at City College San Francisco. And move on to the next slide. Okay. We are humiliated as a college, as stupidest people on earth, with the worst virus disaster that has ever been heard of in the mind of man. At the beginning of this year, all over international media came this information that we were... outrageously lax in our network security, and all our computers were infected by viruses, and in fact, they stayed that way for 10 years, and nobody ever noticed. Go to the next slide. And so the virus trojans and malwares, which look like that apparently, were infecting all our machines. Go on to the next slide. And every time anybody would type credit card numbers or anything useful, these bugs would crawl out down the screen and take out their data and send it to the Russian business network. Go on to the next slide. And we never told the students, all of us teachers, it looks to me like this teacher here actually knew about it and is snickering quietly. But anyway, we just let all the students get all their data stolen. And go on to the next slide. And so this was never found by any of us until we hired these contractors named USDN, which seems to be a one-man show as far as I can tell. But anyway, they were hired. And what they did was they installed intrusion detection systems, or to be more correct, they installed network forensic devices on our network, which were used to watch the outgoing traffic. And they discovered, looking at this traffic that had never been examined before, that we were sending packets to IP addresses which were on a list of suspicious IP addresses for command and control services. And that was the basis for this statement that all our machines are hopelessly infected. And so go on to the next slide here. This went around the world. It went viral. Here it is in IEEE Spectrum. We're still infected by a computer virus from 1999. Go on to the next one. Here's the new television news about it with more pictures of our poor innocent students having all their data stolen. And one of the next slide. And here's another one from the San Francisco Chronicle with a picture of one of our labs. It was on the front page of the Chronicle, and then it went all around the world. And that is the end of the story. As far as anybody that listens to the media will know, that is where it all ended. So go on to the next slide. Now, I've talked, a lot of times in the security community, we talk about outside attacks and protect ourselves from them, and then some people worry about insider threats. But we have a whole new one, which is deluded insiders. This stuff, which 99% of the people read the media believe, and they always will, because the press left, nobody's going to ever find out the truth from me. I tried calling them, they won't even talk to me. It's all bullshit. It never happened. There are no viruses, there was no breach, there was no data stolen. What happened is we hired a new CTO. The position was created for some reason, which I do not know. They decided they had to have a chief technology officer at the college. And so they had a hiring committee that examined people. And the one of them they looked at and said, this guy is no good. For God's sake, don't hire him. So
one
they hired
minute.
Him. What's that?
1 minute. Keep going.
1 minute. 1 minute left or 1 minute?
No, no. That just keep going. Yep.
Is that 1 minute left or 1 minute expended?
Go.
Okay. Anyway, all right. So I'm sure they end up getting countdown it this way. Anyway, so the point is, he immediately alienated everybody at the college. Everybody hated his guts. He abused people and put out lies about them, and he changed his story about everything and did not fulfill his duties in the slightest until his only friend on earth was the contractor, USDN, who would come in and be his buddy, and he believed everything that guy told him. And that guy is almost a schizophrenic. Man randomly throws out data. He takes random network security terms and throws them together to make science fiction stories. And so he invented this story you just heard. Because when he put on this Alien Vault device, he turned it on in his default settings and discovered all these packets going to IP addresses on a list that he thought was suspicious and made no further inspection. Now, as hopefully a lot of you know, if you turn on a network security device and do nothing, it will be full of false positives. And these are all false positives. After 4 months of struggling, I got them to finally cough up the data so we could look at it, and it said that 4,000 of our machines out of 10,000 are infected, but it said that the most hits are coming from our Unix DNS servers. They're all infected with Windows viruses. Because when email comes in from these people, it sends packets back to the servers to harvest more information or for reverse name lookups or for things like that, and this default setting interprets that as an infection. We were unable to ever find any infected machines except one lab where some people actually took the antivirus off the machines because they were running too slowly. Now, if you do take the antivirus off the machines, you end up with some viruses. And the other thing which is amazing is that we've had 10 years of continuous infection. Aha. Okay.
Keep talking.
Okay.
Use your time.
Well, all right. Anyway. So I'll tell you a little more if you give me another time. We'll see what he says.
Two. One. No, that was your 5 minutes.
Okay.
How about an extra? Can you wrap it up in 15 seconds?
Sure, just go on to the next slide.
Okay.
This is what eventually happened. We had huge lynch mobs, a petition against this guy, and we ejected him forcibly from the college. He's not allowed to set foot on it again.
10 seconds. Ready.
That's it. All right.
Okay, when I say 1 minute, that's 1 minute. That's, you actually have 2 minutes left if the audience likes you, or 1 minute if they don't. That's what I mean when I call 1 minute. So that would you actually, that's 1 minute until I ask the audience for extra time. So if you think it's going well and they like you, they'll give you an extra minute after that. So does that make sense?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, you got that? All right, sorry. I'm sorry. yeah, did you want to introduce yourself real quickly before you start?
Oh, well, I can introduce you.
Okay, all right. Okay, so you ready to go?
Yeah.
And starting 5 minutes now.
Okay, I would like to talk about the future of robotic assistant. So you can see two pictures here. On the west side, this is Rosie from the animation Jetsons, which is the western image of, I believe a lot of people here saw that, western image of robotic assistant. And Doraemon here on the right is the eastern image of that. So if you come to like China, Japan, or anywhere in the eastern part, they will recognize that. Next slide. So this is the reality. On the left side is PR2 from Willow Garage. It costs $400,000 to buy one. On the right side is called KROBot. It's developed in Europe, and it doesn't have a price yet because it's not available. And actually, next slide. Oh, actually, I lost one slide here. So there are another two examples. One is called Hubo2, which is a humanoid robot developed in Korea, which still costs $400,000. And another example, as everybody knows, is Asimo, developed in Japan by Honda. It's not available. So this one is the open source robot that I know, the only one that I know, that is actually a humanoid fully functional robot. It was funded by EU, some kind of EU commission to promote this technology development, and it was developed in IIT, which is in Italy. It's totally open source, but it's too expensive for, you know, hacker community or hobbyists to build. Next slide. What I'm going to do, and I'm currently doing, is a project called Dora Open Source Robotic Assistant, which is basically is a family affordable robot. So the goal is to provide family affordable robotic assistant available as the actually commercial product in 15 years. And I will design it, or I want the project to be designed in a way that robot hobbyists or hackers can build it in any hackerspace. So we use like low end limited tools like just like normal like 3D printers and laser cutters. So there's a project website, it's called dorabot.com, and you can email me at how@dorabot.com. Next slide. Next slide, please. This is a totally open source hardware project, so everything will be open source, and it will run ROS as the software. So if you've ever heard about ROS, it's a robot operating system which is developed or originally developed by people in Willow Garage. And it's totally open source, and it's used by more than 100 research institutions and universities in the world. So you got this whole community support that software end. And next slide. I want this project to be rely on community effort like RepRef, so everybody can get knowledge and skill from the project, and you are totally welcome to upload or open up your improvement on the project. And also, I want to focus here. You are welcomed and actually encouraged to make money out of that, to you know, sell whatever you got, like robotic kits or fully assembled robots, because I want more people to be involved in this project and more people to get the chance to research on the robots. Next slide. So this is what I'm doing now. This is the wheelchair robot in Northbridge in the hackerspace in San Francisco. I'm working on now. So it looks like that. It's a wheelchair. It has a computer on top. It runs Ubuntu 12.04 and ROS 4.8. And you see there's a gigantic robotic arm, but it's pneumatic, so it's actually not functional now. Next slide. So what the progress I've done is I took apart the huge robotic arm and made it to, you know, controlled by electric like controllers, like made it controlled by motor, and I'm still doing that. So these two pictures I took 3 days ago. Then I fly here for hope. So on the right side is the touch sensor, which I believe there's no other, you know, like cheap but capable touch sensor available. So I built that, and it will come out later, like I don't know, maybe in 3 months.
One minute.
It will come out later in 3 months, and it will be about $20 each, and you can search on it. It's called Dora Touch. I'll talk about it later. So on the left side, you can see... Okay, so I want to point out that because I have totally no money on the project, so I'm using all the resources that I can get in Northbridge. So this robot will be built at no cost. Next slide. Okay, so this is how I did this Dora Touch sensor, which will be open source.
30 seconds.
And it's pretty simple. On the left side, I use CNC machine to mill that, and I researched a little bit on that, so I will publish how I make PCB board in CNC machine. And on the right side is the actual the chip. I'm turning a barometer into this touch sensor. Next slide. So how do you involve? You can join the discussion group, and you can totally help me improve the website because I don't know how to design a website. You can start building one robot right away in the local hackerspace.
Yep, that's just say thank you to the audience and ask for a round of applause, and that's good. Okay. And then give them the website real quick.
Okay. So next slide, you can see the information.
Okay,
you see my information about here. So if you can contact me or if you want to build robots in your local hackerspace, just, you know, start away.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and next up is Tuna talking about the Miami Pwn Machine CTF contest downstairs. Okay, so just to go over this real quickly, just one more time. You've got 5 minutes, and at the error, I'm sorry, you've got four minutes.
I have to pee, so I'm not going to be that long.
Are you sure?
I really
do. You know how this works? We went over this.
Cool, I do need another beer.
Okay.
I'm out. All right, 4 minutes starting when?
Now.
Okay. I'm not as cool as everyone else up here who's talking about I did this, I did that. I'm just here to represent Miami Pwn Machine and Hack Miami. I've actually, you know, worked with Nick at UAS.
Get a little closer to the mic.
Oh, this thing right over here? I worked with Nick over at UAS, and it was awesome. Right now I'm in Miami, and this guy, Rod, he put together this really awesome CTF. It's not like one of those crazy CTFs that, like, you know, you perverse stuff and whatnot. It's actually really fun, and it's real like, lifelike. You know, you have to compromise websites. There's, like, one MS08067 for a little hint out there if you want to, like, think cool and shit. You know, it's really fun. It's down in the mezzanine level. And, you know, just come and play. It's just come in, bring your laptop, plug in. Nothing hardcore, nothing fancy. And if you want some help with maybe, like, one flag, we can probably hook you up with that. So, you know, enjoy and have a good fucking time. Oh yeah, and thank you for being Grove.
You had other slides.
We have slides. The slides didn't really mean anything. Here, and you took out all the animations. Like, all right, let's go through the slides really quick. All right, everyone know what that is? if you don't, Google it. All right, next. That was a GIF, and it was fucking awesome. And it was a dude dancing. He's all fat. And then there's, like, you know, Men in Black shit. All right, who knows what this is? This middle one. All right, if you know what that is and you tell me what it is, don't scream it out, you get 5 extra points at the CTF. It's the one-eyed monster in Baltimore. He's fucking awesome.
You mean the Bohemian Beer one?
Shut up! All right, next one. Oh, see, so this is like, you know, he's rubbing his balls and it's Jesus. Everyone loves Jesus, you know? All right, what do we got next? All right. What this is I was trying to show you how easy, you know, it is to play the CTF. So it's as easy as this. I mean, if you can't figure this out, then don't come play. But, I mean, you know, pretty simple. If I offended anyone, next slide, I also have a kitten. Because kittens are awesome. This is my favorite, like, fuck you. Oh, no, cute kitten. Is there another slide?
No, that's it.
That's it? Oh, sweet. All right, hey, come play the CTF. Have a fucking awesome time over here at Bohemian Grove, and we love you.
Okay, I have to get off the stage, but if you would like to give a slightly more serious lightning talk on a serious issue, just check out the wiki, wiki.hope.net/lightningtalks. The lightning talks will also appear immediately after the keynote, tomorrow after the S-Men. So if you've got a quick idea, 4 minutes and with an extra minute from the audience, sign up. Thank you. Okay, from five, let's just practice that one more time. You guys ready? From five, you ready? Okay, let's just get that buzzer sound just one more time. From three, can you guys get the buzzer sound good? Doesn't matter what the numbers are, just as long as the buzzer sound is good. Ready? Okay, all right, that was great. So let me get my timer going. Mitch, you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Okay.
My voice isn't.
Oh, dear.
But I am.
Okay, so are you saying that we're going to have to be a little bit quiet for your presentation because your
voice is... I can talk
into
the mic.
Okay, all right. Let me just get it. So reset five, starting now.
Hey, I have an interesting and perhaps weird project that I have a Kickstarter for that I would like to present about. My contact information, contact me for any reason, go to the next slide, please. I created the Brain Machine Project. Have any of you tried it? It is weird and it's fun, and you hallucinate beautiful colors and patterns along the way as you're lulled into a cool meditative state. I wrote it up for Make Magazine, and the next one. It uses brainwave frequencies. There's like a bunch of science behind it. There's been studies, but there's a lot more to go, so no double blind stuff. So is it real science? Is it pseudoscience? I don't know. It helps some people. If it helps you, cool. Go to the next one, please. So you can go through, you can record a brainwave sequence. You can also play it back through sound and light. And you can go through what you would go through if you were, for instance, going from awake to asleep. Your brain synchronizes is the idea, and you follow along, and maybe you'll drift off to sleep. Next. So, you know, that's really the idea. If you play it back, will it work? Well, it seems to work for a lot of people. Next. Now, this stuff's been going on for a long time. People would beat drums at alpha and theta frequencies, which are low, sort of subconscious, drifting off into spaciness. This guy in the second century, he noticed that when he drives by, he was rich, so he had a carriage, he's going by tree-lined driveway, and the sun would beat through, he would hallucinate. He did it over and over again, and he wrote about it. Go ahead. And in the 20s, we started recording brainwaves, and the first guy who did that in humans also played them back as a base for his studies. Next slide. He, by the way, went on to do the first robot research. Read up on him. He's really cool. In the 50s, there was a beat guy, Brian Geisen, who made
Three
a
minutes.
Dream machine. And he liked hallucinating, as some people here might also. It's a really cool, beautiful thing, the dream machine. In the 70s, it was the first patent for these kind of things. Go ahead. And then people started seeing at discos, if you use these frequencies and blinking lights, you get the crowd really going. Go ahead. And then there's a bunch of people who seem to be, you know, pretty grounded, and other people who make these massive claims, some cool, some not, whatever, it's up for you to decide. But we also started seeing that some people with epilepsy didn't like blinking lights. Next slide. So, jump ahead. I wrote that article I talked about in Make Magazine, which was actually a simplification of this thing I've been thinking of for 7 years and working on for 7 years. And it turned out to be one of Make Magazine's most popular projects because it does turn out that a lot of people really do like hallucinating. Go ahead.
2 minutes.
Yeah. It's also popular at parties and photogenic. So, go to the next one. That was a very simple machine that worked with one brainwave frequency at a time, and it makes square waves. It's kind of annoying, but it's good for hallucinating. Next slide. This one is very gentle. It doesn't have meditation sequence. It has a sleep sequence, and it has beautiful noise with pulse width modulation, and it has fading lights that aren't harsh, so you don't hallucinate, but hopefully it'll help you drift off to sleep with its sleep sequence. So there's a bunch of stuff for further study that'll be up on the online, so you can see it. Go to the next slide. And you can make your own because of, like, everything. This is an open source project. All the plans are online. And I have this Kickstarter there. You can go to Kickstarter and search for either my name or NeuroDreamer or what I always use, Maltman23.
Extra time?
Cool. So there's the Kickstarter address. I need to raise $66,000 if it's going to be successful to make the first unit the same place I do TV Be Gone, which treats their people really well, pays them well, and the same people who work there year after year. They're fantastic people. I go and visit them every year in China. Next slide. There's my contact info. If you want any questions, feel free. And if you want to try it, just come to the hardware hacking area where I'll have these available. Right now I've got to go to my panel and get ready for the Geeks and Depression panel where I'll be a part of that. So thanks, everyone.
Huge round of applause for Mitch. Thank you. Local autonomy networks, are you...
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay, round of applause for just being ready like that. That's amazing. Okay. All right, so you only have one slide.
Yes.
Ready? Go.
Hi. My name's Micah Cardenas, and I'm an artist, theorist, and I'm a survivor of sexual violence. And what I want to ask today is, why is it that we have better technology for uploading pictures of our lunch and downloading our favorite TV shows than we do for preventing violence against people?
Sure.
So, in response to that question, I'm working on this project called Local Autonomy Networks, or AutoNets for short, AUTONETS, and the website is autonets.org. And so AutoNets is inspired by a drive to create networks of communication to increase community autonomy and reduce violence against women, LGBTQI people, people of color, all people who continue to survive violence on a daily basis. So those networks that I'm forming in this project are online and offline, including handmade wearable electronic fashion and face-to-face agreements between people. So I'm working with groups like queer youth of color groups in Detroit, or sex worker group in Montreal, or a group of artist activists in Bogota, Colombia, to make these devices that will, when activated, they would use mesh networking technology to alert everybody else who's wearing a device that somebody in the network needs help and which direction to go to find that person. So mostly I wanted to do this talk to ask a call for collaborators. So if anybody wants to help work on such things, on safety hacking and safety technology, then come talk to me. So the main part of this project is a line of mesh network clothing with a goal of building networks that don't rely on corporate infrastructure to function, inspired by community-based, anti-racist, prison abolitionist responses to gendered violence, because we all know the police are not our friends. And so it's based on wearable electronics, right? It's a new form of electronics that is enabled by threads that have conductive material sewn into them, and I'm using LilyPad Arduinos and XB wireless transmitters and LED lights. And initially,
3 minutes.
My idea was 3 minutes past?
No, just 3 minutes to go.
3 minutes to go, okay. So initially the idea was to make this line of mesh network clothes that have GPS transmitters in them, which would be an easier technical problem to determine direction that way, right? But when I started talking to groups like sex workers or people in Latin America who were often disappeared by the government, they were like, we don't really want a GPS tracker. We don't really want to transmit our GPS coordinates anywhere. So I've been working instead on trying to figure out how to use just the XBs to determine location information, which I find is a difficult technical issue. So that is something that I would love to have help with. And as we all probably know, governments from Egypt to San Francisco have demonstrated that they're willing to shut down cell phone networks to prevent dissent and protest. So I'm thinking if we have these wearable garments that provide us locative information about where our friends are, we could use them for things like protests when the networks get shut off. Or in ecological or economic crisis, obviously large-scale communication networks fail, and so mesh networking technology could save people's lives. So the idea here is that we cannot depend on corporations anymore to provide our technological infrastructure, our communications infrastructure. And to really change the story about violence, sexual violence and gendered and racialized violence, so it's no longer seen as an individual problem to be solved by individual people, but seen as a social systemic problem to be solved collectively. I actually am under time. So... Oh, so you can come to our panel, Electric Bodies, Impossible Worlds, at 4:30 in Sassaman to learn more about this and see some of the prototypes I've made in action. But the basic idea of this project is something that I call, or that people I work with and I call, science of the oppressed, which is to think about how science could be something else if it weren't based on corporate interests and corporate funding, and to think about how experiences of oppression, like gendered oppression or racial oppression, can be a specific form of knowledge that we can build from and have, you know, unique perspectives and different kinds of technology. And so that we can think about things where, like, why is it that when we think about the future of technology and bodies, since a lot of us in this room think about this, we think about things like contact lenses with computer displays embedded in them, instead of thinking about things like wheelchairs and lipstick and prescribed hormones. Right? I mean, what if we're thinking about the future of augmented bodies or the future of how we're putting our bodies together with technology, why don't we learn from people who are differently abled or people like me who are transgender who have their bodies permanently biologically modified or people who are so-called mentally ill who have a different experience of the world? I think we can learn a lot from these people. Thanks for listening.
A Museum of Reclaimed Urban Spaces, are you here? Museum of Reclaimed Urban Spaces, going once, going twice, Sold. Okay, crypto tools for distributed social media. Crypto tools for... Huh? You're here? Okay, awesome, cool. All right, so you've actually got slides, so when you want to go to the next slide, just say slide real quickly. You've got
right.
5 minutes. You know how this works?
I know how this works.
Okay, everybody give Vladimir a huge round of applause and let him go.
Hi, thank you for coming to Lightning Talks. So who am I? I'm Vladimir Sedac. I'm a member at Foolab, the Montreal Hackerspace. And this talk is going to talk about some cryptography developments that I think will be important for distributed social media, things like anti-censorship-proof Twitter and Facebook. Now, this talk isn't going to explain anything. It's just going to point you out to what's out there and the possibilities and things that you could research further. Next slide. So what's social media in this context? Basically, let's limit it to sharing text and pictures with your friends who you can find and then later unfriend if you don't want to share with them anymore. Next slide. So what does it really mean to be distributed? Well, I consider it two scenarios. Either you have everything that you need on your phone, or if you don't have your phone, you can go to the library anywhere and just log in from there. So there's no home plugs, there's no buying your own server. Next slide. Now, the question is, where is the server? How does this work? Is this magic? No, it actually depends on a very old technique, store and forward messaging, which was the basis of Unix to Unix copy, FidoNet, and Usenet. And it depends on your friends having their machines and being online, whether that's their phones or their desktops. So you still, if you're at the library, you still need a web browser and some sort of public website to go to load the initial payload for the application, which uses WebRTC, and to sort of find some of your friends so you could bootstrap that whole process. Next slide. So what already works? Message authentication codes for store and forward messaging, and public key encryption for identifying your friends and providing a secure channel for communication. Next slide.
3 minutes.
So can you really trust your friends with your private data? Well, it turns out you can. There's developments like Tahoe LAS, the least authority file system, where basically encrypt and then kind of chop up your data, and you could have it on less than trusted machines and they can't access it, so you can let your friends have your most private data and store it for you, and you'll all still be secure. You could sort of trade off storage. They have their machines online. They don't need to be all on the same online all the time because it uses erasure codes. Next slide. So can you trust your friends with your password? It turns out you can. There's a big area of research in cryptography called zero-knowledge password proofs. And right now, real zero-knowledge password proofs are not not practical, but it's not computationally intractable. It's either we wait another 5 years or maybe there'll be a breakthrough. So it's like takes 10 minutes, 100 megabytes of transfer, but we can really get that down. So next slide. Can you trust your friends with your private keys? And this is really interesting, this paper. It turns out that you can if you have more than one friend. You can assemble a private key knowing only a password and having some of your friends around. So I think that's going to be really, really important. Next slide. So what about identity? Well, when Bitcoin came along, it turns out that having blockchains is also useful for doing naming, as you know, Namecoin now tries to do for a distributed DNS. So that's going to be fully distributed and, again, secure. Next slide. Now, how would you unfriend someone? And this one I find is the most interesting. Broadcast encryption was developed by the copyright mafia for cable set-top boxes, and so they could lock out your DVD players when the keys got compromised. And now I think we
extra
can
time.
Turn that into we can turn that into cool new tools for piracy. Turn that around on them. Next slide. So once again, I'm Vladimir Sedac. If you look me up on Twitter, I posted these slides and more links. And if you want to talk about this more, come see me. Thank you.
Awesome. Online map censoring, are you?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, another person ready to go. Sweet.
Cool. That's the HTML version?
Yeah, that's the...
Sweet. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no problem. Okay.
Okay.
Ready?
So, yeah. So here's a funny story. When you go on Google and you search for Israel and you find, like, you look for online maps of Israel, next slide, then what you see is this. This is the best resolution that you can get of aerial imagery of Israel. Now, it's not because Google doesn't have the like better resolution. It has it. But Google is bound by a United States law that requires it to not show pictures or images that are better than 2 pixels. 2 meters per pixel. So, next slide. So the state of Israel actually got this clause inside a U.S. law. It's the National Defense Authorization Act of 1997, basically limiting the dissemination of high-resolution imagery of the state of Israel. And that's a U.S. law, so that's kind of weird. So Israel is very paranoid about people seeing aerial imagery of Israel. Next slide. So when you go on Google and you look at Tel Aviv, this is the Israeli Pentagon, more or less. It's like the main headquarters of the army, center of Tel Aviv, capital of Israel. So that little trapezoid shape in the middle is the base, and this is like the best resolution that you can get. If I zoom in more, you're gonna get it's gonna be blurry again. So this is what you get on Google. Now, if you go on an Israeli map provider, you're gonna get higher resolution, but it's also censored by the state. So if you go on the next slide, you're going to see, I don't know if you can see the very eloquent Photoshop done on this, but someone planted like this huge central park in Tel Aviv, and that park doesn't exist. So so that's what you get on Israeli map provider. So question number one, can we diff these two versions of the maps to try to find these places that someone has censored? So that's the first question. Second question is, on the next slide. So now we have a new map provider in Israel, which censors this place like this. So basically pixelizing entire areas of interest.
3 minutes.
So again, a high value target, and it's pixelated. Now, the second question is So what can we do with that, and can we manipulate these images using CV libraries, namely OpenCV or any other image manipulation techniques, to find these pixelated areas? So, for example, we've applied a Hough transformation on this image to find lines in the image. And that's just one technique. You know, we can try to think about other techniques that we can use to find pixelated areas. So basically two questions. Next slide. So one is that, small. So how can we diff two different images of the same area and try to programmatically see if they have been censored? And second of all, can we recognize pixelated areas within a single image? I'm starting to look at this. If there are any CV people that know this stuff and can suggest better methods to do this, please approach me. I would be happy to talk to us about you you get the idea. under time, but that's it.
Yeah.
So thanks
a
lot.
Great. Give him a round of applause. Thank you. Stealing passwords remotely. Okay.
All right.
All right. Returning presenter.
Yeah.
From last time. Was it okay last time? I felt bad. I cut you off at the end, but you like had. Yeah. You like were right there.
It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
One guy said it was a good story.
Yeah.
Anyway, what do you think of this one?
Just to be clear, because I was asked to clarify this, they have 5 minutes to give their whole presentation, but the audience can cut them off at the fourth minute. And I'm going to do my best to try to count down 4 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes.
That's all right. I got my own clock anyway.
Okay, extra time. All right, great. So at the 1 minute mark, I'll ask for extra time. And if they like you.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I won't need all that time anyway.
Okay, right. Ready?
Yeah.
Go.
All right, so I'm a bad guy. I want to steal your password. Next slide. Okay, that's me. Next slide. Okay. So if I want to steal your password, the easiest thing is if I can trick you into being a moron and signing into a stupid site like this that doesn't even encrypt anything. This is HTTP, so next slide. If I just get your network traffic, your password is sent over to wire and it clears, so that's easy. But the other thing, which I didn't normally think about, is on the next slide. Your password is also stored in the RAM of your computer. If you're using a Windows machine, this is just raw RAM, and your password is just in the RAM in the clear. So next slide. If I want to protect myself, I use a secure website, HTTPS like Google. Now if I sign in here, my password is encrypted on the Internet, so it's harder to steal, although we know there are a few tricks. But next slide will show it's still in the RAM in the clear because the browser author did not think about this. So if I could just read your RAM, I could get all the passwords you've typed into websites pretty easily. But that's one target. A more interesting target is to steal your login password. You want the next one. So your Windows login password, for some reason which I do not understand, is also stored in RAM. The next slide. Now, if you look in RAM for the password itself, you will not find it in plain text. But if you go to the next slide, it is stored in an encrypted form, and this fellow, Hernan Ochoa, wrote the tool to decrypt it. There was an earlier version called Mimikatz. Go to the next one. This thing decrypts it. It finds the encryption key and decrypts it in RAM, works on all modern versions of Windows. So go to the next slide. And so all you have to do is use Backtrack, the social engineering toolkit, and use any attack that will give you the ability to run the Windows Credential Editor on their machine. The one I use is a Java exploit because it doesn't require any vulnerability at all. It's social engineering. The user is presented with a useless warning that says, this site is attempting to run a Java applet. Is that okay? User says, yes. And that's it. Next one. And you just get the password in plain text. It's this thing here that says your-name-12345. It can be as long as you want. You don't have to crack a hash. You don't have to do anything. And it works in all modern versions of Windows. So that's all I wanted to tell you. This is a lot of fun to play with. All right.
Okay, and next up, Matthew Borgatti.
Howdy. All right. Let me just get my notes up here. Boom.
Everybody's coming in under... A round of applause for all the presenters who came in under time. You haven't had to... reduce one of them. Okay, Matt.
All right. So I'm just going to point to you and advance the slide. So this is Robert Sapolsky. He has mad stats in neurobiology. He also is a professional baboon molester. Now, I don't mean that in an insulting way. He actually tranquilizes baboons as part of his job. He spends half of the year in the savannah tranquilizing baboons, and the other half of his year teaching at Stanford. So what ends up happening with this is he studies the baboons' social behavior. They have stressful lives. They fight with each other. Baboons will rip each other apart for the chance to dominate the other baboon and mate with all the ladies. It's a very competitive, stressful life for them, and they suffer from the same effects of long-term depression and long-term stress-related disease like heart attacks and hypertension as we do. Which is weird because things like giraffes and zebras don't. Giraffes and zebras only have two modes, which are off and run for your life. So they don't tend to deal with long-term stress because as soon as the stressor is gone, as soon as they can't see a lion, can't smell another angry zebra, they don't have to worry about stuff. So one of the interesting things is depression is a stress-related disease.
Four minutes left.
Excellent. Lots of similar symptoms. Next slide. So I'd like to talk about depression and stress-related disease. This is Sapolsky with one of his friends. We have complex brains and complex lives, a little like baboons. And so we have this ability to spook ourselves, to give ourselves stress, to give ourselves the things that actually activate all of these interesting mechanisms inside of our brains that cause more stress. So if you think about yourself and your life and the fact that you're going to be put inside of a box one day and buried in the ground and you're going to, that heart's going to stop and you're going to decompose and the room went quiet and that stresses you out. It's a thing that stresses you out that doesn't have any physical characteristics. It's not that another angry, next slide, human is coming up to you and trying to savage you. It's your own brain giving you this stress. And so one of the interesting things about neurobiology and what it suggests for depression is it's partially, next slide, that there are structures inside of you that cause you to release these stressful chemicals called glucocorticoids. It's cortisol is one of the primary. Next slide. Ones in the human biology. What it does is you have these neurons. These neurons talk to each other across synapses. So it goes that one neuron is talking to the other ones. It has a mouth, more or less, and ears, more or less. And across that gap, there's this place where chemicals flow. That's the synapse. And when you have stressors, like the cortisol, starts squirting out of your brain, and it does a lot of good things, next slide, for you immediately. So what ends up happening is immediately, instantaneously, you get faster at running and you get stressed out and you remember things slightly better. You can picture like times when you are about to like take a test or something like that, and there's this period where you're hyperproductive because the stress is making you better. And then after 8 hours of this stress, you are a blob of meaningless nothing that you can't write and you can't think and you can't remember stuff and you can't remember what you were reading an hour ago. And part of this is because initially... Initially what's happening is that all of these dendritic spines, the things that are receptive to this glucocorticoid stuff, are really, really excited. And then they start dying. And then the more this goes on, you start getting neurotoxicity. You start getting these patterns that are etched in your brain that actually start making you more and more sensitive to cortisol, more and more sensitive to these repetitive thoughts that stress you out, and you get stressed and stressed and stressed and stressed, and your hippocampus starts shrinking. Next. And so what's interesting about this is there are many, many repetitive cycles in depression. There are many repetitive cycles in stress that cause themselves to repeat themselves that you can't get out of. And many of the therapies on this, if I can get extra time, I will talk about two of the therapies. All right. So two of the therapies are electroconvulsive therapies and MAOIs, and I will describe them both really quickly. So electroconvulsive therapy, the thing where you have at the end of Cuckoo's Nest, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where the guy is being shocked and his brain is, I think that's how it ends. I've never seen the movie. So the electroconvulsive therapy is meant to try and restructure how your synapses work with each other.
45 seconds?
Yes, to try and scramble what you're doing with your brain, to essentially try to get you out of these habits of thought and out of these habits of stimulators causing this auto-stimulation feedback loop where you are stressed out and you make more cortisol and you stress yourself out and you make more cortisol. So that sort of kind of works.
30 seconds?
On the other side, you have MAOIs, which are monoamine oxidase inhibitors, which try to keep serotonin inside of your brain longer, as in there's a thing that rips apart serotonin. And if you put an MAOI in the thing that rips apart serotonin, it doesn't exist anymore. So you could totally get over depression if magic happened and your brain worked even better.
Warren.
I'm done!
Okay, Hackertown. Okay, SciTech, you were here. All right. Do you know the drill? Ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, we're running really low on time, so hurry up. Go.
All right. I'm SciTech of Alpha One Labs. We're working on a project. I started Alpha One Labs 3 years ago, co-founded Alpha One Labs, and we've learned a lot of things when having a hackerspace, and one of them is that it's like a gym. So some people make excuses to not go to the gym, so we want to make it very easy for people to get out. We're making Hackertown a block away from the train, the Graham Avenue L train. And what Hackertown is, it's a pioneering educational center for clean technology and sustainability featuring the world's first marketplace for hackers. Next slide, please. So we're buying a parking lot a block away from the train, and we're going to get recycled shipping containers and build up a huge building for hackers with a retail store on the bottom, and we're going to have tons of classroom area, co-working space, event space, full machine shop, including
five-axis
CNC, 3D printers, waterjet, laser cutter. In addition, we'll also have the Alpha One Labs hackerspace located there. And a new thing that's kind of different than the co-working space is a me space, where you can rent a room out, be by yourself, work on your project in solitary calm. We're going to be off the grid, completely powered by solar panels, wind generation. We're going to have a gym where people work out and actually contribute back to the grid. We're going to store it all into a hydrogen fuel cell. And then we're going to have 9 acres of agriculture, because each container can hold about an acre of food. We're going to dedicate 9 acres for food production and sell it back to the community. This is going to be on Kickstarter in about a week. We're going to raise $5 million and make this happen.
With 3 minutes left to spare, Replicounts. Replicounts.
Ready?
Okay. You got one slide, and SciTech had 3 minutes left.
Yep, that's
so,
it.
Ready? 5 minutes, go.
My name's John James, and I'm actually I have a scheduled presentation, the Felsenstein Room unscheduled presentation, tomorrow at noon. So I'm looking for collaborators, too. Anyway, what it's about is that today there could be online financial accounts that could reproduce, like independent children accounts, which are basically a copy of the parent. Then they can reproduce and so on. So you can have generations of these things. It means that an account can have a family tree. And the reason it's important is that you can inherit infrastructure like settings and services. And it's basically ends up as being a way that you can manage a much more complex infrastructure than easily than you could otherwise do. So what are some of the examples that do with this? One thing for security, you know, since you're making accounts all the time, you can make new accounts very easily. You can destroy them very easily, or they can self-destruct and transmit the money to any remaining money to an undisclosed location that you set up in advance. When you might make an account that only has $5 in it and never has any more, and is sent on an email to a certain, like, special email address that somebody may get at this particular server, would charge the account 5 cents and pay that to the recipient. Well, 5 cents is going to kill the business model of most spam. Maybe some phishing not, but in other words, the account is so little that you can put it out in the clear and send it along. You don't have to worry about the encryption and all the things you would otherwise have to worry about. So
3 minutes.
Yeah, another example. Well, actually, the big example. A real central problem we have today in the whole world of the internet is how do artists and journalists and so on support themselves for online work, because the internet works best if everything is free, and well, second best if a big company like Apple does a big system like iTunes and gets everybody to sign up for it. That has disadvantages. And so the just click to download free, that's an excellent model. Well, with these accounts, you can set up what I call smart links. Oh, is the slide's not up? Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. There's in blue there just a made-up example. So in other words, it's a simple link. So it links
to
a record in a database. And it can, for example, someone could sponsor a particular song that they like, or a work of a particular band that they like, or a journalistic report that they like, and maybe sponsor 200 copies at 50 cents each, pay $100, and then using that link, and then the first 200 people that click the link and choose to download the art can do so free. Now, they also get a chance to add more sponsorship, and the sponsors can send out a short message to people who use the content they paid for, advertising or otherwise, all those 200 get a chance to add more sponsorship if they want, so meaning that smart link can circulate indefinitely, and it can actually reproduce other links, and there's a lot more to it. So I'll be in the Felsen Steam
extra
room
time
tomorrow.
Okay.
Well, thanks, but I'm not ready anyway. I'll be in the Felsenstein room at noon tomorrow. We can talk about this. I've been developing this for a while and looking for people to work with.
Okay, great. And one last final round of applause for all the lightning talks. That's all we got. And I'm going to hand this over to Rob T. Firefly. Thank you very much.